you are standing at the precipice of both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing progressive speakers to campuses and communities across the United States. If you enjoy the program, consider becoming a monthly patron to help us expand our reach and impact. For as little as $2 a month, you can gain access to special bonus audio commentaries unavailable anywhere else, as well as signed books and DVDs, among other goodies. And every donation is tax deductible, as it goes to Speak Out and help support their educational and activist mission. If you're interested, head over to www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and help support progressive podcasting today. My guest today is Charles Badger, a political consultant and essayist who for many years described himself quite proudly as a black conservative and Republican Party operative. Raised in public housing in the city of Nashville, Charles began imbibing conservative philosophy in middle school, went on to graduate from Berea College in Kentucky, and afterward worked for a number of GOP office holders and candidates, including Senator Mitch McConnell, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, and then as a coordinator on the 2016 presidential campaign of Jeb Bush. And yet, over the years, Charles has come to see the way that the Republican Party and conservatives more broadly have neglected the concerns of communities of color and poor folks, much as he had long seen the same to be true with Democrats. Indeed, in the era of Trump, one might say Charles has discovered his inner progressive, and while we on the left might wonder what took so long, it's always good to have new allies, and frankly, it is sometimes better to embrace those who have worked on the other side of things and know where the bodies are buried, so to speak. I wanted to speak with Charles for three reasons, really. First, because I've always been impressed with his deep intellect and command over the issues, even when I disagreed with him, which has been often, by the way. Secondly, because it's always good to talk to another native Nashvillian. And finally, because we both graduated from the same high school, Hillsboro, here in Nashville, albeit 21 years apart. Though we took very different paths to our current politics, the trajectories are increasingly aligning. And so it was great to sit down with him a few weeks ago at my place and talk about the state of the nation, the de-evolution of black conservatism, what's really behind Trumpism as a political phenomena, and what are some of the policy ideas that folks can work on at the state and local as well as national level to reduce racial and economic disparities that have long plagued the nation, among other subjects. That conversation coming up right after this week's commentary. So today we're going to have some fun. We're going to talk about a story that is in the news, and then we're going to spin from that into a discussion about how to recognize and to pick apart disingenuous, stupid-ass arguments made by conservatives. Probably heard right before the end of the year, there was a big story. It was in all the national papers. It made CNN and MSNBC, and I don't know if it was on Fox or not, but it was all over the press, that crime rates in the city of New York, this nation's largest city, have fallen to really historic lows, the lowest rate since the 1950s. In 2017, there were 290 killings, which of course is 290 homicides too many, but that's down from 335 the year before. And that number was in turn down from the year before and the year before that. The number's been dropping consistently, really, for 20, 30 years. Both of those numbers, both the 335 homicides in 2016 and the latest data, 290 for last year, way down from the numbers in 1990. In 1990, there were 2,000
245 homicides in the city of New York. So that's major improvement. So, you know, as someone who loves the city of New York, it's a wonderful thing to know that crime has dropped so dramatically in that period of time. Rapes are also down, larcenies are down, assaults are down, car theft down as well from the previous year. The reason this is such an interesting news story, though, in addition to just the fact that it's great news, is that this is several years after the aggressive policing policy known as stop and frisk was thrown out by Judge Shira Scheindlin, who ruled it unconstitutional. And of course, Bill de Blasio, the mayor, came to office proclaiming his opposition to it. And all of the police union folks and the supporters of conservative crime theory and stop and frisk and get tough on crime policies all screamed and yelled. And they were saying that if you don't do stop and frisk, if you take away this tool from law enforcement, it is going to lead to a bloodbath in the city of New York. It is going to lead to chaos. The argument being that it was stop and frisk that was bringing crime down. By 2013, the year before stop and frisk was thrown out, the New York Police Department had been stopping and frisking literally millions of people. That year, the New York Daily News reported on a study from Columbia University, which found that out of 4.5 million stops, roughly, that those stops were almost unbelievably unsuccessful at actually stopping serious criminal behavior. About 94% of the time, the person stopped wasn't even issued a citation for anything. Out of the 6% where they were either ticketed or arrested, half the time the case got thrown out once it got to court for lack of evidence. So 97 out of 100 times, really, the police stop and frisk ended up being unjustified in terms of any criminal behavior by the person stopped. 88% of the time, roughly, the folks who were stopped were either Black or Latinx, and they only turned up 5,940 illegal guns, meaning that the unlawful possession of a weapon was discovered in less than 0.1% of all the stops. And so ultimately, in late 2013, a federal judge, Shira Scheindlin, rules that the NYPD's practice was unconstitutional, forcing the department to reevaluate that practice. And again, everyone screamed and yelled, crime is going to be out of control. By 2017, because of the change in policy, police stops and frisks, that kind of aggressive policing, had fallen by 98% to about 12,000 such stops. Now, there are certainly some who would argue that that is an over-exaggeration of how much the stop and frisk policy diminished. Obviously, there are folks who would argue it's still happening too much, and there are certainly people who have been unjustifiably stopped and searched. But whether you believe the 12,000 number or not, no one is going to deny that the policy has changed dramatically. No one is going to deny that far fewer people are being stopped and frisked today than were being stopped and frisked at the height of that policy, where it was like 600,000 to 700,000 people a year. So all these folks screamed and yelled, it's going to lead to chaos. And now we know, of course, that it did not. Every year since stop and frisk was thrown out, violent crime has continued to drop. The New York Post, which had been banging the drum about how it was going to lead to chaos, acknowledged over a year ago that they had been wrong. And recently, even some others who you might not expect are acknowledging that they were wrong. Kyle Smith wrote a piece in the National Review, which is the Bible of the conservative press, saying, you know, we were wrong that this was going to somehow lead to chaos. So, you know, it is nice when people on the right occasionally will acknowledge that they don't know what the hell they're talking about and that they were wrong. And I think that's a great thing. Of course, there are others who refuse to acknowledge that they were wrong. And that's what we're going to talk about today. The first example, The Washington Times, which is the conservative paper of record, really, in the nation's capital, they did a piece the other day which looked at the statistics and tried to throw sort of a wet blanket on the claim that crime had gone down in New York. The article provided no evidence, quantitative statistical data claim evidence, to suggest that the official data was wrong, but they did have a lot of interesting opinions. So they quote the head of the police union, a guy named Pat Lynch, the most unironically named cop in the history of policing. They also talked to retired detective, New York Police Detective Bo Deedle. Bo Deedle. I say it like that because that's pretty much how he says it, if you ever have seen him on Fox. They also talked to former Commissioner Ray Kelly, and all three of them say, we don't believe this. We don't think crime dropped, you know. And why? Well, not that they have any different evidence, not that they've done any research, not any studies, no collection of data, but simply because they say people tell us they feel less safe. So the statistics must be wrong. They don't identify who these people are. They just say, and we're supposed to believe them because they're cops. Bo Deedle wouldn't steer you wrong. Bo Deedle. Right? Pat Lynch would never lie. No, of course not. So people tell them they feel less safe, and that's supposed to trump no pun intended, the actual evidence. And this just, you know, I think proves the point about the incompetence of the New York Police Department, because if the New York Police Department thinks that someone's opinion equals evidence, no wonder their stop and frisk policies were so unsuccessful. I mean, they were wrong 97 out of 100 times in their stops and frisks. There'd been no actual provable criminal activity. So they clearly don't know how to evaluate actual evidence of criminality. And here we can clearly see they don't know how to assess actual statistical facts either. These people clearly are not very good investigators, not very good detectives, Bodeedle. So what do they say? They say, well, the stats are wrong because people tell us they don't feel safe. Keep in mind, the statistics that they're now claiming are not accurate. Where do you think those statistics come from? What do you think, that's some liberal ACLU fairy out in the forest that just makes shit up and puts it on a spreadsheet somewhere? No, that data about crime, that's the result of official police reports. That's not like some leftist in a sociology department sitting in a corner just making up numbers. That's the result of official police reports. So why would police fudge the information? Is that what Bo Daedle is saying? They're making shit up. Is that what Pat Lynch is saying? That the members of his union, the Police Benevolent Association, or whatever the hell that's called, that they're just making things up? I mean, this data is the result of official collected information by law enforcement. Why in the world would they fudge the information? Second point, this statistical data is culled the same way it was back in the day when the numbers were so high. It's not like they changed the methods of collecting the data. So if they want us to believe that those super high homicide rates back in 1990, where there were like 2,200 murders, if you want us to believe that that data was correct, and you certainly do, why is this data not correct? Not to mention, third point, it's a little hard to hide dead bodies. So if the evidence now suggests that homicide is 290 cases a year, what does Bo Daedle want me to believe? What do he and Pat Lynch want me to believe, that there are people who are at hundreds of people, thousands of people who are being killed, but nobody's reporting it? We're all keeping it hidden. It's all being covered up. What the hell are they saying? It's absurd. What they are arguing is that quality of life offenses, really minor, sort of the old broken windows theory of policing, which was so, you know, prominent in New York in the 1990s, that those things aren't being policed as heavily. They actually lament the fact that people aren't getting arrested and thrown in jail for urinating in public. Now, urinating in public isn't cool. Like, I don't like that either. But come on, the idea that if you're, you know, we're not busting enough people for that. Well, look, the point is they're not. You're right. They're not busting people for that. And yet serious crime isn't going up, which actually proves that the whole broken windows theory was bullshit, because that whole theory was premised on the notion that if you don't aggressively police the minor offenses, then the major offenses will explode. And once again, that is not true. And then Ray Kelly, best one of all, former Commissioner Ray Kelly, says that, you know, again, people perceive that they are unsafe. And he goes on to say, hey, you know, perception is reality. Oh, is it? Perception is reality, except, I should point out, when people of color were saying that they perceived stop and frisk as a war on them and their communities, then apparently perception didn't mean shit, right, Ray Kelly? Right, Bo Daedle? Perception didn't mean anything when it was black folks telling you they felt like the NYPD was an occupation force. And black folks say that, they're accused of being cop haters. When black people say that because that's their lived experience at that time, perception doesn't equal reality. Perception in that instance means paranoia, right, Ray Kelly? Right, Bo Daedle? Right, Pat Lynch? Right? See, perception only counts as reality when it serves the purposes of the NYPD. Screw these people, seriously. Absolutely ridiculous. But then, of course, there's a much more sophisticated argument. That one, Bo Daedle is a freaking amateur. Pat Lynch is an amateur. Ray Kelly is an amateur when it comes to denying reality. The pro here, the expert here, is Heather McDonald. Heather McDonald, the Manhattan Institute conservative author of the book The War on Cops. She is one who has been defending stop and frisk for years and years and years, going back to when it was at its zenith and 680,000 people a year were being stopped. And she was one of the ones who said, if you stop this, there's going to be a bloodbath. This has been instrumental to bringing crime down in New York City. Now that the crime rates have dropped, even as stop and frisk has gone away, she has to come up with a rationalization. She can't admit she was wrong. At least that guy in the National Review, let me remind you what I said a second ago, Kyle Smith, God bless him, in the pages of the National Review, said, hey, we were wrong. But the National Review being the National Review, this is a publication that still hasn't apologized for supporting segregation, which it did under its head, William F. Buckley, for many years. This is a publication that actually blamed black people in the city of Birmingham for planting the bomb in the 16th Street Baptist Church that killed those four young girls in the summer of 1963. They haven't apologized for that shit yet. So here you had Kyle Smith, you know, apologize, but then the National Review being the National Review, they had to hedge their apology. So they let Heather McDonald have a rebuttal piece, I suppose, to Kyle Smith, where she says, now hold on, not so fast. Let's not assume that stop and frisk wasn't necessary. Let's not assume that this drop in crime proves that we didn't need stop and frisk. So you read this piece, and again, this is, she's like the number one defender of racial profiling in this country. And she will rationalize anything. There's never been, I've yet to see a single incident of police killing a civilian that she hasn't sought to rationalize. She is justified and rationalized every single case without an exception that I can find. That's who Heather McDonald is. But she writes this piece and couple things. She's still trying to rehabilitate stop and frisk. So she writes the piece. She refers to a National Academy of Sciences study, which she says proves that stop and frisk is effective and that it was critical to the drop in crime in New York City. Except the problem is a guy named David Weisbird, who's the chair of the NAS, the National Academy of Sciences Committee on Proactive Policing. He is the chair of the committee in this organization that actually looks at this issue. He's also a professor of criminology at George Mason University in Virginia. And he says, in response to Heather McDonald's argument, that in fact, although certain stop policies involving searches with reasonable suspicion can certainly be helpful in addressing crime, I don't think anybody denies that, that the NYPD's indiscriminate use of the tactic gave very few benefits in the city of New York and yet had a very high potential for negative effects in the community. So in other words, the guy that actually studies the issue for the National Academy of Sciences says that Heather McDonald's interpretation of his work is bullshit. And yet Heather McDonald, of course, insists that the NAS says this is a good policy. She then goes on to do what she often does. She says, a black New Yorker is 50 times more likely to commit a shooting than a white New Yorker, according to perpetrator identifications provided to police by witnesses to and victims of those shootings. In other words, her argument to justify stop and frisk, and she's made this argument before, that the overwhelming majority of violent crime in New York City is committed by black people. Therefore, it makes sense that the stop and frisk would have targeted black people or maybe Latinx people as well. The problem being, and I've pointed this out in previous articles, that the vast majority of stops and frisks under that policy were not related to investigations of violent crime. So therefore, that data is irrelevant. And how do we know this? We know this because the NYPD's own data says so. They have to fill out forms when they do a stop and frisk under the old policy that explain why they made the stop. And only 15% of the time did they even claim to be investigating a violent crime. Meaning that regardless of what the violent crime data does, that's not what the stops and the frisks were about. You don't stop people randomly on the street and search them in the hopes that you're going to uncover last night's liquor store holdup, man. You have more specific information to go on. You've got eyewitnesses. You've got maybe video camera evidence. So you're not just going to randomly stop people. That'd be an incredibly inefficient way to try to find suspects, right? Bo Deedle would know not to do that. The NYPD, surely to God, Pat Lynch doesn't want us to believe, and Heather McDonald wouldn't want us to believe, that police are so stupid that that's the way they investigate crime. What they're doing with stop and frisk was not investigating crimes for which they already had descriptions of perpetrators. They were investigating people in the hopes of turning up crimes that were not yet in evidence, things like drug possession. They weren't actually using that as a principal investigative tool for already existing crimes about which they knew something. And so Heather McDonald throws around this data like it means, it's like she's an illusionist, right? She's doing something with one hand over here to sort of distract you from what she's doing over here. She's rationalizing a policy by using data that is not remotely related to the application of that policy. And here she does it as well in this piece in the National Review, right? She says that a black New Yorker is 50 times more likely to commit a shooting. Now, why is she making the argument this time? Well, here is the main argument she makes in this piece, is that the reason crime has dropped, even though stop and frisk and aggressive policing diminished, is because stop and frisk policing gave rise to gentrification. And so therefore, because wealthier white people started moving into Park Slope and started moving into Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn and started moving into Central Harlem, that the crime rates came down because now you get white people and they're not as violent as black people. Aside from the racist implications of the way she makes this argument, right? Her argument is that gentrification led to a reduction in crime rates. And that is the result of stop and frisk, because those white folks wouldn't have moved into Bed-Stuy and wouldn't have moved into Central Harlem and wouldn't have moved into, you know, Brownsville or wherever had it not been for stop and frisk. So in other words, that's a way that she tries to still make the case that stop and frisk is due the credit. I want you to think about this argument for a second and how ridiculous the argument really is. First of all, the people who were living in those neighborhoods before they gentrified, one of two things happened to them, right? One of two things happened to these black folks who were already living there. Either they got pushed out by gentrification because the rent went up and taxes went up, so they had to move elsewhere, or they stayed, right? They didn't vaporize. They didn't just disappear off the planet. They went somewhere. I'm guessing they didn't move to Connecticut. I'm guessing they didn't move to Stamford or Greenwich. I'm guessing they didn't move up to Westchester County, White Plains. I'm guessing that the black folks who lived in Bed-Stuy before either still live in Bed-Stuy. Maybe there are more white folks there now because they put up some condos and some high-rise apartments, right? And so now the population density is greater and there are more white people. So the black percentage dropped a little bit and the white percentage went through the roof, but they didn't just disappear. So those black folks who were supposedly so bad and horrible and criminal, right, and dysfunctional and pathological, coming from broken families, blah, 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 all the stuff Heather McDonald likes to talk about, they're still there. So if, in fact, their culture was to blame, if, in fact, the fatherlessness of their family unit was to blame, they should still be committing crime. If they got pushed to a different community, why aren't they committing crime in that community? Because this crime drop was citywide. It didn't just happen in the gentrifying neighborhoods. It happened all over the city of New York. So if people got pushed out and they're still not committing crime, or they stayed behind and they're not committing crime, then that must mean they weren't criminal. And that's an important point, because Heather McDonald's argument has always been that these folks who live in these communities or have been living in these communities, you know, they live in broken homes, quote unquote, they're being raised by single moms, they don't have dads around. That's what she says is the main reason for crime. Well, here's the, you know, newsflash for Heather McDonald. These family arrangements didn't change in the last 5 years or the last, you know, 4 years since the end of Stop and Frisk. These family arrangements didn't change. The percentage of kids being raised in single parent homes didn't change. And these families didn't just disappear wherever they're living, whether it's in the old neighborhood still surrounded by some newcomers who happen to be white, or whether it's in a different part of the five boroughs of New York City that maybe is not as white and hasn't gentrified yet. They're still fatherless, right, quote unquote. They're still living in quote unquote broken homes, but apparently they're not committing crime, which is to suggest that it was never the quote unquote black cultural issue. It was never the cultural problem. It was never the family disintegration problem. You know what your argument actually proves, Heather? This is what your argument actually proves, that the left was always right about crime. Because what has been the primary argument that liberal and progressive and left-leaning folks make about crime? The argument has always been what? That the reason we have crime rates that are disproportionately high in certain communities is because of economic deterioration. And whatever one thinks of gentrification, and I've certainly been critical of the way that it happens, but the one thing that even the critics of gentrification would acknowledge is that it amounts to economic revitalization. So the left argument has always been that economic deterioration is what is the primary driver of crime. And if you're going to argue that the reason that crime has dropped is gentrification, you've just granted that argument. Thank you very much, Heather McDonald. You can retire now. If gentrification is why crime drops in a neighborhood, then by definition, the left argument that economic development and or economic conditions are the key to crime rates has been proven. And therefore, we can dispense with all this cultural bullshit, all this blaming of hip hop, all this blaming of black culture. Crime has actually, generally speaking, been dropping. It's about one third less. The violent crime rates in this country are about one third less on average than they were in the early 1990s. Actually, most violent crimes hit their sort of peak in 1991 and have been dropping consistently ever since. So we're talking almost 30 years, where crime has been dropping pretty steadily. And that has been during a period when black culture certainly hasn't changed. And by the way, Heather, and all conservatives, Bill O'Reilly and folks who like to blame rap music and hip-hop culture, it was during that period that hip-hop exploded. Hip-hop as a culture is now the dominant cultural form on the planet, and yet the very communities that are ostensibly the most immersed in hip-hop culture are seeing a decline in criminality during that period. Now, I'm not stupid enough to make the argument that hip-hop is causing crime to drop. I'm just simply pointing this out as a way to push back on this notion. There's something culturally about blackness, culturally about black communities, culturally about black people that explains crime. Her argument, Heather McDonald's argument, that gentrification is what caused crime to drop, if gentrification is connected to the drop in crime, and I'm certainly willing to acknowledge that, that simply proves that what we need, if we really want to deal with crime, you don't have to change the black family, you don't have to change black culture, you don't have to sit there and bash hip hop. What you have to do is make sure that there's economic development. It'd be nice if we could get that economic development without having to have rich white people move into Brownsville or move into Bed-Stuy. It'd be nice if the people who already lived there could get the city to pay attention to them and to invest in their communities ahead of time. But the bottom line reality is that if economics are the key to crime rates, then let's start investing in high crime areas, whether or not white folks show up. So Heather McDonald may not realize it. She's just made the case for the complete evisceration of conservative crime theory. She's made the case for the elevation of progressive and left crime theory. Thank you so much, Heather McDonald. My work here is done. And now my conversation with political consultant and writer Charles Badger. So first, I'm excited to talk with you for a number of reasons. I mean, we've chatted before and been connected on Facebook for probably 7 or 8 years. I think you reached out to me, and at first I was confused because here was this conservative dude. That's what your page said. You were like working with Mitch McConnell or whatever in Kentucky, and you were this Republican operative and this conservative. But then I realized you went to the same high school I did, and I thought maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. You know, he's intrigued by the fact that this crazy leftist went to school with them. And I was intrigued by the fact that this conservative guy went to my high school much younger. You're about 21 years younger than I am. So it was cool. It was exciting. And I followed your trajectory. And it's been a very interesting journey that you have been on. And I want to talk with you about that before we get into sort of the state of American politics today, and particularly as it relates to the Republican Party and conservatism and your trajectory from where you started to where you are now. Let's start with where you started. So you grew up, I think it's fair to say, here in Nashville, quite poor in public housing. And I'd like for you to talk a little bit about how that experience shaped you in terms specifically of your outlook on life and maybe the connection between that and your early foray into conservative thought. Because it's probably a trajectory most people would not assume. If you grow up in conditions of economic deprivation as a black man in America, becoming a conservative isn't necessarily what people expect. So talk a little bit about that.
One of my mentors by the name of Bob Woodson out of D.C. runs the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise and now the Woodson Institute, long time on the right and as a conservative, interestingly. He has this quote he loves to say that I think is really on the money. He actually said, if you to grow up poor person of color, child in America, basically, you're going to live a largely public existence, public housing, public schools, publicly assisted, free and reduced lunch, what have you, take public transit. So you're living a largely public life. And so that was definitely my experience. And you're absolutely right. There has been a tremendous evolution on my part over the years. And I guess the way I think about where I started now is about deficiencies in those transfers of services, of government services, to low-income people in this country. And so I think that the place where I eventually got to, and certainly am now, is about kind of how we optimize those services and how folks who, families not of means in this country, ways in which we just don't do right by those folks. And that's both on the private and the public side.
Well, I mean, it is sort of interesting because I think the difference perhaps between where you start your political awakening and where a lot of us who've always been on the left started ours is, issues of resource deprivation, issues of public insufficiency in those things that you mentioned are sort of abstractions to a lot of us, right? If I don't grow up the recipient of those public goods, maybe, public schools, yes, and public parks and public libraries. But if I'm not receiving any kind of income support or housing subsidy, if I'm not receiving nutrition assistance, then I can look at that stuff and not really see the defectiveness in the actual delivery, putting aside the intentionality of it, right? I'm not experiencing the general shittiness of the way that we take care of poor folks in this country. And you are. So you're sitting there thinking, this is not empowering my family or the people around me. And it might make sense in a way for you to think about the people who are seen as behind those things, which are not the Republican Party and conservatives, right? That's seen as this sort of democratic and more liberal thing, is be like, well, y'all aren't really, you're not really down with this community. And so it actually isn't that weird that you might say to yourself, let me go a different direction. And I know you told me in a previous conversation, for you starting out when you were like in middle school, I think you said you were reading reading Ann Coulter, and I know you're embarrassed by this now, perhaps, but this is an important part of the story because we all grow. So talk about that. You're like in seventh or eighth grade, and you're reading this.
I eventually got to reading the better stuff, like Thomas Sowell, in my opinion.
right.
People who actually have some thought content going on there.
Right. Yeah, but nobody starts with Thomas Sowell.
Exactly, you know? Exactly. Right, yeah, right. That was a process to get there.
Right.
But also, I mean, you said something interesting there about, you know, the Democratic Party and kind of, you know, the other feature about, again, those kinds of communities that I come from is, yeah, I mean, you've got these kind of old style machines in terms of the Democratic Party as an institution. And it's fascinating because we're having this national conversation post-Alabama.
Yeah.
Certainly all of my other political operative friends who work in politics on the left, you know, this is the hot topic right now about, you know, essentially the Democratic Party taking black folks for granted and the black vote for granted. And so it's so fascinating that that's a major, you know, national discussion right now. And I think it ought to be. And certainly on the right, black folks and people of color that I know on the right have been having that conversation for years and years and years. And so, you know, everyone knows this. It's been an open secret forever. And it's nothing new that the black vote is taken for granted. And so, you know, political scientists have long time talked about, you know, black vote as a captured vote for exactly that reason,
right.
That you've got one party in the Republicans who make essentially no effort really even at all to go to even be appealing to voters of color, and largely on the structural level, no outreach or engagement even with communities of color, and then sort of advancing a policy agenda that at best is sort of indifferent to the needs of people of color, and at worst, certainly in the current climate we're at, we've gone past indifference to outright antagonistic, right, to communities of color. And
well,
so, yeah.
And what's interesting about it, though, this is a party that whenever that point is made, they will retreat to the sort of standard, but we're the party of Lincoln, right? We're the party that was really responsible for the passage of the Civil Rights Act, which is only true if you read that vote in a non-regional way, because, of course, we know that was really about the South versus everybody else. And at that point, you know, there were only 10 Republicans in the House who were from the South. They all voted against the Civil Rights Act, just like the Southern Democrats, but they claim to be this party of civil rights and anti-racism in spite of the fact that for 60 years, they've been sacrificing their black base, which was part of their base. When did the party decide that it didn't need these votes? Because it had relied on black votes for a long time.
Well, two words, and everybody knows the answer: Southern strategy. And that's the pivot that happened in the 60s and the 70s. I mean, it starts with Goldwater in 64. Lee Wright Regoor up at Harvard, political scientist up there, wrote a book maybe a couple years ago, and I got to chat with her about it, History of African Americans in the Republican Party going back to the 40s. And, you know, she makes this point. I mean, she quotes Goldwater, for example, the famous quote from that 64 campaign where it says, we have to go hunting where the ducks are, right? I.e., court the backlash reactionary white vote and jettison this black base that we've historically had. I mean, Goldwater says that explicitly, and then you get the architects of the Southern strategy, beginning with Nixon in the 68 campaign through the early to mid-70s, you know, folks like, you know, Kevin Phillips, his chief guy in the 68 book about the emerging Republican, you know, majority. I mean, he says explicitly, right, the more Negrophobe whites in the South leave the Democratic Party, they're going to be coming into our party. And
right.
he says, we no longer need more than about 10 to 20% of the black vote. You know,
right.
Kevin Phillips says this in 68
right.
in the emerging Republican majority. And, you know, he, with Pat Buchanan and these others, influenced Nixon. And there was a concerted, deliberate, intentional decision made by folks in the party to do exactly that.
You mentioned Bob Woodson, and I think there's a pretty profound and stark difference between the Bob Woodsons of the world on the right. And I know, you know, I don't know if he still really defines himself as the right or if he sort of views himself as somewhere more independent than that.
Bob
now
has this wonderful term. He calls himself a radical pragmatist.
Right. I mean, I feel like Bob Woodson, when he made the decision, for instance, to break with the American Enterprise Institute over the support for Dinesh D'Souza when The End of Racism came out, and he was one of only two or three that did that. But he very forcefully said, this is racist trash.
Yeah.
And I'm gone.
He and Glenn Lowry.
And Glenn, of course, had a few years before that had started to come to the realization that he was getting used.
Yeah.
I feel like there's...
Glenn has had a journey like me.
And I saw Glenn Lowry speak when I was in college at Tulane in the 80s, when he was just mid-80s to late 80s, when he was starting to rethink, but he still couldn't quite completely break away from the folks who had really crafted his career, his public career in a lot of ways. But I always felt, even though I profoundly disagreed with him, and I found his understanding of the white power structure to be pretty naive, I never doubted that Glenn Lowry and Bob Woodson cared about black people, right? I never, ever doubted. I thought they were wrong in terms of their prescriptive designs for policy, but I never thought to myself, these folks are performing for white people. Today, we have a very different brand of black conservatism than the Bob Woodsons and the Glenn Lowry. It seems very performative.
Well, I'd argue they're not even conservatives. And you're right, it is very much performative. You know, Colin Powell, I always tell people, look at, you know, 96 speech he gave at the RNC, sure. Right, calls out the hypocrisy, right? He goes, you know, people complaining about affirmative action, but nary a word about loading up the tax code with loopholes for special right. interests
and they're booing
by lobbyists,
him.
Right?
There are people booing him from right. the floor right.
exactly.
of the
And
RNC.
He didn't care. And he right. didn't care, right. which right. is what I love so much about and respect so much. It's like, look, I'm going to stand in my own truth and I'm going to speak my truth to power, whether you like it or not.
And right. And then you look at the crop of quote unquote self-styled black conservatives today. And, it, you know, Sheriff Clark, ex-Sheriff Clark doesn't give a damn what black folks think. He's performing for white people. That's what the cowboy hat is. That's what all that stuff is. You know, Stacey Dash, you know, is not going to say one cross word about Donald Trump. This is a very different crop of people who I feel are more concerned about how white folks will respond. Why do you think there's been this shift from the more intellectual black conservatism of the Glenn Lowrys, the Bob Woodsons, the Thomas Sowells, who, again, I think they're two Thomas Sowells. They're the Tom Sowells that did the syndicate column, which had to be much more polemic and oftentimes, I think, really reactionary. And then there are the Tom Sowell books, which even when I disagreed with them, I found things in there that I found fascinating. Why have we come from that to this? Is it just the media age? I mean, what's going on?
Well, because
that?
One makes money and the other doesn't. That would be my answer to you. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, there's a lot of chasing of dollar signs. Yeah. And, you know, I wrote a piece before. Look, when you speak out and you stand in your own truth, it comes at a cost, right? Speaking out, standing up, being contrarian, you know, standing in your own truth and calling out people on their crap, it isn't popular. It can make you not have some friends, lose some friends. Mm-hmm. It can make you lose some powerful and wealthy benefactors. And, you know, and the other style is good at making money.
So then let's switch gears a little bit and talk about Trump and Trumpism in this particular moment. I know you have worked for a lot of different Republicans. You worked on the Jeb Bush campaign. You know, may that rest in peace. And, I mean, you know, I'm tempted to just say what happened and let you have at it. But I mean, seriously, sort of what happened? Like, we all know the analysis, obviously, around the way that Trump tapped into racial resentment or the way that he tapped into, you know, the ephemeral economic anxiety, that whole analysis. But what else do you think might have been going on?
Let's introduce into the discussion, I think, feminist point about intersectionality, which I think is beautiful. And going from a black president to, you know, a campaign with the first female nominee, I think places us right at the nice intersection to examine those overlaps of race, class, and gender. You will recall when Bush ran, I'm talking HW now, late 80s, early 90s, right, the famous was Newsweek or Time cover, right, quote, the wimp factor. One of the things I very, very strongly argued is very high on the list of Trump's appeal is this performative masculinity business.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, he said, you know, the list of quotes is long, right? He says in the 08 primary, Obama, quote, schlonged Hillary.
Right.
You know, word choice for a loss, right? This is a man who famously bragged about his lower anatomy in a nationally televised debate, right? He frequently goes on talking about, well, football is soft now and the concussion thing. And there was the quote about putting the hand on the head of people, cops, when they're putting him in the squad car, right? It's all of this bravado, big man, big stick, pining for the good old days when, right, the protester would be led out on a stretcher, right? This sort of stuff, right? It's, you know, there was the famous Dr. Oz interview where he really wanted to talk about his testosterone levels, right?
Yeah.
You know, all of this, right, just over and over and over again, right? It's this performative masculinity stuff. That's what's being tapped into.
Right. Well, that was why I remember during the primaries, a lot of us thought, and I was never a Secretary Clinton fan. I also have my issues with Bernie Sanders for different reasons, because I think he has a lot of blind spots around race and a lot of other things. But a lot of us thought, oh, Trump's the one guy she can definitely beat. But actually, based on what you just said, what we didn't understand is actually that's the one guy she probably couldn't beat, right? For specifically the reasons, because when you're this performative macho guy and you're running against a woman, that's going to work a million times better than if you're just running against another guy who maybe doesn't have to match you jab for jab in the masculine thing, but it's just the fact that it's another guy sort of moots that out, right? So in fact, if anything, maybe that was a huge miscalculation to think, yeah, that's the guy we want. We want that guy because everybody realizes he's a clown. When in fact, guys were like, yeah, that's a lot of guys, white men, let's be honest. And we're sort of like, that's the dominant protector ass kicker, right, that we need. So getting back to this issue of how the parties and how conservatives traditionally, well, not necessarily traditionally, but in the last 40 years, there seems to be, rather than the Bob Woodson, Glenn Lowry discussion about what's really going to help poor folks and folks who are struggling, there's been instead a conversation that isn't about that. It isn't about what works or what's better, about which honest, good folks can disagree. It's more about taking on the and attacking the people who rely upon various forms of government intervention, mm-hmm. rather than taking on the intervention and saying, there might be a better way of doing this, which every leftist I know is going to tell you that TANF and SNAP and all those things are not sufficient. I mean, I don't know anyone on the left who actually believes that a program that provides $318 a month mm-hmm. as a median benefit is actually even intended to alleviate poverty, let alone capable of doing it. So we all have these, left and right, tend to agree like these aren't necessarily the ways to go about it. But it seems like the right for 40 years has been more interested in just bashing the individuals. Why do you think that, other than the obvious that that's a good way to chase votes, why do you think it's so hard to get us to at least see one another in human terms and not make it about these people are lazy, these people are defective, these people are pathological, rather to have a discussion about what actually works? Why did that become the trend within the party? And do you see any chance for the Republican Party as a party or for conservatives as conservatives to move away from that personal attack mode against poor people and shifting back to a discussion about anti-poverty policy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I encourage everyone to read that Martin Gillen's book from the late 90s, something like The Color of Welfare or the couple
Why
of
those, Americans
right,
Hate Welfare.
Why Americans Hate Welfare, exactly. And between that, there were a couple of sociological, you know, accounts around then looking at, you know, I saw one study that looked at, you know, nightly news TV coverage yeah. from like this, you know, 60s, maybe late 50s through about, you know, 70s, 80s, maybe goes up to the early 90s. And you literally see the face of poverty changes on American televisions.
Yeah.
That there's a pivot. You know, this is where the news media has a tremendous role in this and has a lot of the blame for what's happened, is that you physically see a shift in the color of the faces that are in stories about poor people in poverty on the nightly news. It shifts from, you know, white Appalachians to a decidedly black and brown face, right, progressively through the late 60s and the 70s and 80s. And then so the second to that, I would add, then, as we look to, there's been this long-standing kind of conversation in political science about the Nordic countries, right, and why they have these large welfare states over there.
Right.
And, you know, I am persuaded by the argument. It is because they are overwhelmingly white countries.
Which is why they have them and why
exactly.
they are allowed to have
exactly,
them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You, when you have that level of homogeneity in right. a population, to your question and to your point, it's much easier for people to get to that empathy, right? As a result, the Nordic countries have these giant welfare states because there's so little diversity. But then and there's been a lot of, you know, articles on the recent trends in immigration through
They're
Europe.
They're wanting to cut back on
exactly.
those now. Yeah.
We're in a huge, right, austerity moment right now. And it's obviously much more prominent in Western Europe, right, your Britons and your Frances. The Nordics are still far whiter than their colleagues to the south. But everywhere where you start getting, the population starts getting more of color,
right,
you start getting these rumblings around, well, moochers and makers
and
takers.
That's when everybody discovers their inner libertarian is when black and brown folks move into the neighborhood, whether that's the literal neighborhood or the country. I mean, you have the UK, you know, actually thinking about, and you hear rumblings now about getting rid of the National Health Service, which you didn't hear that under Thatcher. I mean, nobody, yes, the Tories always talked about streamlining it, making it more efficient, but they never, ever talked about repealing it in the 80s. And now you have open discussions about, like, we need to get rid of the key building block of our welfare state, which, you know, again, the thing about the Nordic countries versus the U.S. models of social welfare has always struck me that, and that was always our argument on the left, was, look, you keep talking about how these programs make people lazy and these programs, but and they don't work, but yet they do work when you truly invest in them and you actually put the money in. So the right was ignoring the evidence, but what we were ignoring was the reality that, yeah, but the reason you can't get away with that is race. So that means those of us on the left who care about strong safety nets have to make fighting that racism that short circuits the success or the efficacy of those efforts, that has to be front and center. You can't just run a campaign that says we need more public jobs or we need to invest it. You know, when Bernie Sanders talks about the need to have a bigger social safety net, if he doesn't talk about race and why, then that's not going to go anywhere.
Exactly. This is exactly Bernie's problem and what Bernie doesn't get.
Yeah. Right. I mean, and it's to some extent, it's why the New Deal programs only could work so much because they cut black folks out of the loop for the most part. It's why, you know, the Great Society programs, which were in place for about 8 years. They start to get unraveled again in large part because of race. Yeah. So it seems like...
Yeah, and those Great Society programs, that goes back to what I was talking about earlier to your original question about those kind of deficiencies of public services, right? You were in that big period in the 60s of, right, these night raids where you had government agents going in the homes of women on welfare looking for the presence of a man in the home, right? Looking for toothbrushes and rummaging through the closet, looking for men's boots and clothes, and this very oppressive, heavy-handed kind of state action. And they're still doing kind of these night raids. Yeah. It's not sort of middle of the night and sort of as arbitrary and bad, but you still have like government inspectors going in the homes of women on public assistance, like rummaging, you know, looking for this, you know, and it is incredibly intrusive. It's incredibly demeaning. And so that's, you know, one of those ways in which, and this, I think it was sociologist Nadasen wrote a great book about the welfare reform movement of the 60s, right? Yeah. Johnny Tillman and these others, right? Johnny Tillman, big speech at 72 and got published in Miss Magazine, right? She stands up at this big women's convention, right? Probably one of the only black women there, stands up, and one of the most powerful kind of openers of a speech I have ever seen in my life. And I mean, it just hits you. She goes, I'm a black woman. I'm an overweight woman. I'm a poor woman. If you are any of these things in this country, you count as less of a human. If you are all of these things, you don't count at all.
And at that particular moment, the welfare rights movement was so far off the agenda of mainstream white feminism, right? I mean, that wasn't the conversation. The conversation, and this goes back to the way that quote-unquote liberals and progressives who are white have taken for granted black and brown folks, because there's just an assumption, oh, well, if we're fighting for women's rights and it's a liberal thing, then these folks of color are going to come along. But if what you're fighting for is, let's say, you want to make sure that women have the right to have jobs on equal terms, which is very important. But if you're black or brown and you've always been working outside the home, in fact, you've been working in white people's homes, you might actually want to work less. You might actually want to be able to be at home, raise your kids. You might actually want, you may be thinking about housing and you may be thinking about healthcare. You may be thinking about entirely different priorities. And it seems like white liberals, as much as we talk about the right, obviously taking black and brown folks for granted because they figure the energy put in is not worth what you get back. If liberal and progressive folks are going to do the same, then they're gonna have to count their blessings when Roy Moore loses. It's so funny, in the wake of this election, and I want to talk about that with you, all these folks are saying, you know, thank you, black people, for saving us, which, I mean, yeah, they did, but at what point do white folks say, holy shit, maybe we should stop asking black and brown folks to save us and actually do some stuff on our own?
This is precisely the problem, in that there's no competition whatsoever between the two parties for the black vote.
You know, how do principled conservatives, of which, you know, I have to assume there are still many, how do they recapture, and not that this is even the project that you're involved in right now, you're journeying through a lot of things and moving to a different place, but I'm sure you still see the value of a multicultural, inclusive, bigger tent Republican Party.
Yeah, and a viable two-party system.
Right.
Which, in my opinion, a democracy needs.
Right.
Not two-party, but a multi-party.
Multi-party.
A democracy, for the health of a democracy, needs a viable multi-party system. And it needs parties competing over the votes of everybody in the country.
Right.
And this dynamic of racial polarization, of herding into parties, is very, very unhealthy.
Right. Well, and if it continues, the reality, just based on demographic trends alone, it guarantees this division is only going to get greater. If the Republicans aren't going to try to compete, you know, as they, you know, famously after the 08 election, they sat down, they have this conversation, they'd been having it before that, about the importance of reaching out to folks of color. It looked like there was this moment where they, you know, and I never really took it seriously, but I at least thought, well, you know, we'll see what happens.
The big autopsy.
And now it just seems like, you know, they just have declared the patient dead and they don't really care why the patient died. Where do those principled Republicans and conservatives go now in a party that really is, at least for the time, Trump's party?
I guess I would say, you know, I'm really in this moment, just to talk about Democrats for a moment and come back to the right, because we've seen them have this. I'm really in this interesting moment of like really deep diving into research and reading about like that whole 80s phenomenon, like DLC and Clinton, right? And this big pivot, right? Clinton coming on the scene with the era of big government is over and all the rest, right? Like what brought about this major soul searching of the Democratic Party in the 80s and caused them to fundamentally change their party? And it was being out of power for 12 years, right? I mean, the entire discussion of Democrats in the 80s and the 90s was we've been completely shut out of power.
Right.
We've got to completely revamp our party in order to be viable and start winning again.
Right.
Now, you and I would both disagree with many of the ways in which they changed their party, right? It ended up being a lot of jumping into that game of courting white backlash votes.
Or Wall Street money.
Exactly.
Or
well, and then the hedge fund stuff. Yeah, and so the list of Clinton things there, right, with the Sister Soldier moment and on all of the rest. And so, right, that's what the Democrats, right, did 80s, 90s, and it was in response to loss, right? Being out of power for 12 years to say, hey, we got to do something different. I would argue, right, so then we get Clinton in the 90s, and I would argue that, right, George W. Bush coming on the scene in 2000 as sort of the Republican version of that, of the corollary to what the Democrats were doing there with DLC, and when he comes along with compassionate conservatism, right, people forget it wasn't just a phrase. He wrote an entire book by that title. Marvin Olasky wrote the, Bush wrote the foreword to it, and, you know, Olasky and some of these others have sort of long been in that sort of tradition where we had this interesting moment during the Bush years. And again, I don't, my friends on the left and you and everyone would have a long bill of, bill of goods and disagreements with Bush. But for example, we had this interesting moment with him and Secretary Rice, with evangelicals, with the whole PEPFAR and interested in AIDS in Africa and malaria issues. Before that, the biggest sort of conservative way that he put life, in my opinion, to compassionate conservatism was his other coinage of an ownership society. And so, obviously, you know, the housing crisis taught us the problems of, 90s, 2000 housing policy in this country. So there were several flaws with it. But the idea of giving folks an ownership stake, and by the way, I think that's important for housing, because, you know, we know that the house is, for most Americans, their number one piece of their nest egg. And so, you know, I'm a strident arguer of the only way that we're going to close race wealth gaps in this country is you've got to raise the value of those homes, right? We have a dual housing market right now, and that is the biggest problem. You take an identical house, right, with identical amenities and the same level of upkeep, one in a black neighborhood, one in a white neighborhood, and there's going to be hundreds of thousands of difference in the value. And given that the house is the number one component of most Americans' net worth, we are never, ever, ever going to make a sliver of a dent in the racial wealth gap in this country until we address that. It's home values are at the heart of that, which is why I'm also a big passionate talker about exclusionary zoning, which is the big piece of this, realtor tracking, all of those pieces. And so that's just core to fixing racial wealth gaps. And so returning that, so back to your question, so that to me was the great revolutionary potential of Bush with ownership society in that way of putting real meaning to the words of compassionate conservatism and what that could really look like for improving folks' lives.
How do we ensure, from let's say a policy perspective, in Nashville, I don't know, you probably know this, we've got zoning laws here that require for every unit of apartment, you've got to have two parking spaces, right? Which means, aside from what that does to traffic, but it also takes land out of circulation, because you got to build parking lots and you got to build garages. You take land out of circulation, it drives up the price of what's left, and it makes it impossible for people who are younger or on fixed incomes to. So what are some of the ways that you think, you talk about exclusionary zoning, what are some ways that we can break down some of these barriers that are at the root of not only economic inequity, but particularly racial inequity?
A major, major, major piece of this is we've got to deal with the issue of bank lending and bank policies, because access to credit is really high on the list of the issue here. And so, you know, and this is also like a major corrective to, I think, what so many conservatives think and say all the time about economics, and it's so funny to me. I always love to throw at them one of my favorite Tom Sowell quotes, and people will be surprised, I guess, to hear a conservative and a conservative economist at that say it. But Sowell goes, you know, capitalism doesn't work without people having access to other people's money. You go to any developing country, right? Every developing country is full of peddlers, poor peddlers on the street, you know, selling their wares.
Right.
And, you know, why aren't they Kmart or Walmart or something else, right? If they lived here, right, it's that infusion of capital, right, by whatever means. And that's how someone goes from being a, you know, peddler on a dirt road to, you know, making some sort of department store. And so capitalism doesn't work without people having access to
Well, they're slinging drugs on the street, too. I mean, you clearly have the acumen to run the business, but you don't have but you can't go down to the bank and say, I'd like to get a loan for $100,000, or you don't have the angel investors that are going to invest in your enterprise, right? Yep. And so you've got folks who aren't able to get credit through traditional mechanisms, and then we know what happens. You know, they can't get credit, they don't have bank accounts, they're having to go to the pawn shop, they're having to go to the check cashing outlet.
And that's what John Hope Bryant's great organization, Operation Hope, down in Atlanta, does great work on what they call the unbanked, and exactly those issues, financial literacy and getting the unbanked folks banked, and then, you know, starting there. Operation Hope is a great organization doing work on that.
Well, it seems like the last thing I wanted to ask you about, because it's just happened, and it goes back to this economic piece again. So this tax bill, this is fascinating, and I want to understand the politics behind it. I think I do, but I want to get your take on it. So here's a tax bill. It's a bill that has like a 23% approval rating or something. Nobody seems to like it other than the very, very wealthiest folks who are going to benefit disproportionately from it. Working class, the folks that voted for Trump, once they hear the details, they ain't really down with it. You know, most families are not, people are not really excited about it. And yet these folks, Paul Ryan is super excited about this. The man that you worked for as an intern, Mitch McConnell, seems very excited about this. Why would folks be so pumped about a piece of legislation that seems to be so unpopular? Is it just they want to be able to say we got something done, or is there something else going on that we're missing?
You know, in general, it's not terribly surprising. I mean, as what I have gleaned from it seems to be pretty standard, you know, kind of policy points that Republicans have been pushing for, you know, decades.
It's not, but yet very different than what Trump was pushing. I mean, Trump's absolutely. Whole thing. Right, was we're going to bring all the jobs back to America, but there are provisions in this bill that will actually create new incentives to keep profits offshore. Right. So is this the Republican Party playing Trump? Is this because they know he just wants a victory? Mm-hmm. They just know he wants to be able to point to something and say, look what I did for America, knowing that by the time a lot of these tax cuts expire on families, Trump's going to be gone. These Republican congresspersons, many of them are going to be gone. I mean, what I'm really trying to get at, how much of their orthodoxy around tax cuts and supply side economics and all this is genuinely believed at a philosophical or ideological level, and how much of it is political posturing for the donor class that makes up such a significant percentage of who backs them? I mean, do you think these are true believers in this?
Yeah, you know, two thoughts. One, to your point about the donor class, and, you know, I'd apply this to both parties.
Yeah.
The number one thing I would argue we can do to get better public policy in this country, and certainly economic and tax policy, is campaign finance reform. Sure. This is one of those areas where as a prescription, I'm a complete radical. I'm for a completely public finance system.
Yeah.
I think we ought to get money completely out of politics altogether.
Right.
And that, to me, is the fix. And so once you remove that element, then we begin to get a government that isn't completely beholden in the pocket of corporate interest and sees their job as only, you know, doing their bidding.
I mean, I know it's hard to project out, and especially in this kind of weird environment where nothing is predictable. But, you know, 20 years from now, if we don't figure out a way to stitch back together a sense of civic responsibility and a sense of community where we can talk to one another without it becoming this personal attack of, you know, you've got tiny hands and you're fat and you're ugly and you're stupid and you're a loser. If we can't move beyond that, if that has, God forbid, you know, poisoned our politics to such a degree that we can't move through, where do you see 20 years from now when they say, now, this country is going to be 50% folks of color, 50% white? What's going to happen? I can't see that being a salutary moment if we don't do something in the next 10, 15 years.
My answer is three words: integration, integration, integration. Kevin Cruz, historian out of Princeton, great book I recommend everyone, White Flight. He does just a complete microcosm about Atlanta in the 60s and 70s. And it's all about looking at how the era of desegregation was not an era of integration.
Right.
Both on the neighborhood level and then how that impacts schools, right?
Yeah.
And same thing, Tanner Colby, some of my best friends are black, picks up that same theme and looks at integration, desegregation in his own life, at neighborhoods, schools, and in industry. And so my answer is, right, integration has to happen, not only for the earlier point that we're making, is I am strident that this is the only way to close the black-white wealth gap.
Mm-hmm.
That's one reason that we need to integrate.
Yeah.
But the second reason is this kind of political, social, cultural one, right?
Yeah.
We're living in the big sort thesis,
yeah,
right, that book, in terms of how we hyper-segregated in that way.
Right.
You add to it the gerrymandered districts, right, which another radical reform. I'm for, you know, Fox should not be guarding the hen house, right?
Right.
Politicians should not be drawing their own district lines, so we need to put those in independent, nonpartisan commissions.
Yeah.
And so you've got hyper-segregation, big sort, we're only living in neighborhoods and seeing and talking to people like us and share our interests.
Right.
And so it's integration, integration, integration. When people are meeting each other in the everyday comings and goings of life, walking the dog down the street or at the dog park, these sorts of things, mixed income and mixed race neighborhoods. That's what we need.
What are some things that schools can do and communities can do, given what the courts have told us we can't do, right? I mean, you mentioned Atlanta. Atlanta had really a voluntary integration program that the courts were like, yeah, you can't even do that. So how do we begin to do this and re-spool, if you will, the notion of not just desegregation, but real integration, when the courts have made it so difficult to do anything race conscious?
Yeah. I used to work in Governor Christie's administration in New Jersey. New Jersey has a fascinating history on all this. They've had this percent of cases called the Mount Laurel cases from, I guess, about the 70s or 80s. And their Supreme Court there has read their state constitution to require a level of affordable housing. Their court has read this as a constitutional mandate on state government there, which I think is an interesting approach. And so as a result, they've had decades of shifting housing policy there around affordable housing and trying to do different ways of, Jersey has, I think it's some like 600 something municipalities. And there, the state government gives all of them, each municipality, essentially a mandate and a quota of, in terms of new housing production every year, how much of that needs to be below market rate and some incentives around integration. I think that's roughly the approach. Jersey's got a lot of kinks in the system and has always, and it's a huge fight and they're trying to figure it out. You know, Governor Christie, I think, proposed at one point something like a 10% set aside, just kind of as flat going forward on all new housing production. You know, something like that is definitely the kind of thing we need to be talking about. In kind of pure capitalist kind of terms, this works out very well. I know lots of local politicians, for example. I've worked with, you know, various city council folks here in Nashville as an example. And the very clear trade-off, it's very easy to do. You get developers on board, is you exchange height for a certain number of set-aside units to be below market rate. That isn't even like heavy-handed government kind of thing that like companies disagree with. I mean, they quickly get on board with that because developers want height. You give them the thing they want in exchange for, hey, this is a public good, right? And it's like, this is a zoning process, right? You need things from the city, public resources, and in exchange, you need to do something back.
Well, now, one of the things you're doing, you have started a new political consulting firm. You're working with traditional candidates, but also with nonprofits around a lot of stuff. Let folks know how they can reach out to you and how they can stay in touch with you and find out more about what you're working on now.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Chuck Badger, and I write here and there as my work schedule allows. And thanks so much, Tim, for having me. It's a blast.
Thank you so much.
That'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Be sure to join us next Tuesday and every week for yet another show, and look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Tumblr at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Podomatic, iTunes, Google Play, and of course, Patreon.com, where you can sign up to become a monthly sustainer of the show and receive extra bonus content unavailable anywhere else. For this episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Gene Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin at Speak Out, my producer Jamie Lynn Moeller, and of course, Brother Ali, for giving permission to use his song Gather Round as the intro and outro music for the program. And that is where we're headed now. Till next time. And the poor and the pious can inspire.